Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, March 2nd, 2014, and welcome to episode 69 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting. If you think that 640K wasn't just enough, it was actually too much, then you've come to the right podcast. This is the place that accepts you as you are, which is, of course, a big nerd. Welcome, you are among friends. I'm one of them. My name is Carrington Vanston, and I've been a big nerd since before it was a fashion statement. It was back when it was something that would get you pantsed. I am joined today by my two fellow pantsties. First up, as they told him in high school, his name rhymes with girl. It is, of course, Earl Evans. Hello, Earl.
Actually, that's the first time I've ever heard that, Carrington.
Oh, I'm going to get in my time machine and ruin your high school.
How you doing there, buddy?
I'm fantastic. And also joining us, of course, is a fellow who needs no introduction to the local police. It is the bad boy of retro computing, Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Right on. Hello.
So it's the three of us this time, just the three, trimmed down for a lean, mean retro computing machine.
The triangular table.
Exactly. We enjoyed it. Well, we've got a fourth space. It's a square for our listener to pull up and silently watch us as we speak.
That's right. Join us.
You're creeping us out, listener. This is how we deal with our audience. Hello, audience.
I know. I've had, you know, so many run-ins with the paparazzi lately. I just don't know what to do.
So today, gentlemen, I am going to be throwing a topic of nostalgia at us. What a shocker. This is new. And I thought we would start, as usual, with a host topic. And since I'm host, I picked the topic. And I am entitling this one, Good Old Golden Rule Days. And the question is basically, what I'd like to discuss for the three of us is what was our first exposure to a computer in school? Like, specifically, all of us should be old enough that probably computers in school was a newish sort of thing. Maybe it didn't even happen until your high school. I don't know. Let's talk about first computer you got access to in schools. Did you take any computer classes? We're all talking pre-university stuff here. This is high school and earlier. Sort of when did it start? Paul, why don't we start with you? What was your first exposure to a computer in a school sort of environment?
Sure. It was my first computer was an Apple. Bell & Howell Apple II Plus that was in, I think this was probably fifth grade for me.
So the black one.
Yeah.
Nice.
It was something that, you know, of course I didn't really have much differentiation between computers at the time. It was the computer that was there. But, you know, now I know that that particular model was targeted for schools and sold only to schools at the time. So it's not that uncommon for people who are exactly as old as me to have
come
across
that.
For
that particular day.
Right. But yeah, so that was the one. There was one computer in the school, I was the one who pretty much had more interest than anyone else. So, it was really not a central thing. It was just sort of something that was available as an activity you could do, and not many people took advantage of it at the time that I was there.
Wow, I had the exact same experience. That's so funny. Different computer, but same sort of idea.
So, yeah. That's where I started. There's more to say about the topic, but we can go around.
Yeah. So, why don't you chime in, Earl? We'll start that off. And what about you? What was your first, like, start at the very beginning? First exposure to a computer in school.
I also have the opportunity to blather on a bit here, but I will keep it short on the first round. First was submitting batch cards to a Fortran speaking mainframe downtown. And this was in middle school. This was in the ninth grade. And I had to bubble in these batch cards with pencil, kind of like a Scantron sort of thing. But they were shaped like a punch card, and we'd stick them in a batch, and we'd send them by courier. And 2 days later, we'd get the results.
That is cool.
It's so primitive. But the other thing we had in the class was a programmable calculator that spoke something that feels a lot like assembly language or machine language. And we could also program it with these bubble cards. And it had Nixie tube readouts. And
oh, my goodness.
I know. I'm really dating myself here. But it was great that that was right there in the class, because it gave us some instant feedback. And then, as I've shared before, eventually our computer science teacher, out of the goodness of his heart, brought in his own personally owned Apple II and let us crazy middle schoolers bang on it. And I've been so thankful to him throughout my career for wanting to do that, for wanting to give of himself like that and let us see what a real microcomputer was like.
Very
instead
cool.
of the Fortran stuff.
That's sweet. And it's funny because when Paul said his first exposure was like the one computer at the school and not a lot of people were interested and he'd go to it, I was saying, yeah, that's exactly me. And it turns out I was wrong. I forgot that before that, it definitely was the case that we did something to sort of introduce us to computers, and it was punch cards or bubble cards, really. And we would fill them out with an H2 pencil and stay inside the bubbles, and they were sent off for some sort of batch processing thing, and then we got them back later. It was something that was sent out of the school, and really nobody was interested in the least except me, it seems. But it was something our school had access to try something. And so we were all sent it off and we would get back printouts. And it wasn't that we were programming. It's like we could fill out something and it would simply print what it was that we had bubbled in. So it was literally that, like, just, you know, fill in your name and you'll get a printout the next day. And it shows you this was your name. So, and just to show us the idea of bubble
cards. Which was super cool.
I mean, I thought so, but, you know, see pants above, so.
But that was the first thing that we did, was do a comment, just a Fortran comment, and kind of like the hello world sort of thing. We got
now, did you ever move past that?
Oh, yeah.
Are you still stuck at Fortran commenting?
Well, no, basically, the code that I write these days is just comments. I mean, because logic is hard.
All comments. I wish the code did this. I wish all comments and no programming makes Jack a dull boy.
The computer is going to be powerful enough to read my comments and actually do what I want.
Go to fail, nice Paul. Yes, exactly. So it's so funny. Then for me, the first computer in school, it was a similar experience to Paul's, whereas there was the one computer, wasn't in even the classroom, it was down the hallway in this little tiny extra room, and you could go down and use it if you wanted. If you finished your math homework early, you could go down and use it, and it was a Commodore PET. And I'm pretty sure it was the first one, the 2001, because I remember it had a chiclet keyboard and had the built-in tape recorder. Now, I don't know how many models were like that, but the one we had was that. And this would have been late 70s, so 78, 79, something like that. I, at this point, I remember when we got it, I already had a computer at home. In fact, I think I was on my third computer by this point. So I was super into computers, and I was the only kid I knew who had one at home. But it wasn't like a PET. I had the Kim one, and like I was basically using that at the time. So for me, the PET was just a monster of awesomeness, because a built-in screen and a proper keyboard and the ability to save programs. And there was another kid named Samir, and he either created or more likely brought in, but at the time I thought, oh my gosh, he made this happen. He brought in a Space Invaders game. So we played Space Invaders on the PET, and it wasn't even really Space Invaders. In fact, I remember it being Space Invaders, but I think it was just some sort of little shooting game where like one or two things would appear at the top of the screen, there'd be a thing at the bottom, and you press a key and it would shoot. But to me, hey, that was Space Invaders. It was amazing. And my mind was blown, because I was, you know, at home doing Kim 1 stuff, which wasn't that exciting, to be honest. So that was my first exposure. So, Paul, yours was an Apple II. Did you take any computer programming courses? Did you, like, what did you do? Like, first of all, on that computer, what were you doing with it? So there's the one Apple II, little Paul sits at it. What does little Paul do with it?
Well, the way I remember it, and this might not be accurate, but the school I went to was actually it was sort of a bizarre elementary school experience.
Was it FAME? Were you doing a lot of dancing?
There was not a lot of dancing, not a lot of singing, but there were I guess it's sort of modeled on the way you schedule your time in college or something. It was a very strange thing where you would, at the beginning of the day, you'd sort of set up your schedule and you'd go to these classes, so there are certain things you had to do. And the way that the way your requirements were done was that you worked out with an advisor a set of goals that you would accomplish. You know, so you would, every week you'd meet with your advisor and they'd say, well, okay, you can do this math. They were called contracts for whatever reason. So you sort of complete the contract, and then you complete enough contracts, and you pass the grade. I guess the reason for my saying all that is that there were options. You could sort of tailor your experience. And so one of the things you could do was a couple of these sort of like tasks on very basic programming. So that's I think how I first got into it. You know, I did the tasks that involved like drawing a little colored line on the computer and, you know, printing and inputting text and things like this. And then I finished the task, but it was interesting. You know, it was the feeling of kind of like, this thing does what I ask it to do. It doesn't argue, it just does it.
Right.
Not only that, but it does exactly what I ask it to do, and sometimes I ask it to do the wrong thing. But, so then after that, I would just do, you know, sort of what you were describing. It would be kind of like time after school or time, you know, during breaks or whatever. It was pretty much mine, you know, from mm-hmm. like whatever 3 to 5 p.m. when school was over and nothing else was going on. But the things I did apart from drawing little lines was probably mostly playing games that a friend, you know, that had been accumulated by friends who also knew something about the computer. There were probably like, you know, I think there were probably something like 3 or 4 people who, you know, knew people had brothers or something like that had discs. And so we would play, like, I'm trying to remember what exactly they were. Sneakers was an early one. But,
sure. Good game.
Yeah. But, yeah. No, it was mainly just, I think it was basically, I got hooked by the programming aspect and then, just kind of wanted to use it all the time.
Right. So. Yeah, I was pretty much the exact same. And what about you, Earl? What did you do? Like you were saying, the first was the punch card thing. Did you end up eventually having some sort of microcomputer in the school with you?
Just that Apple II that my instructor brought in.
Right.
And he left it there.
So it was. Oh, yeah. You had said that on the previous show. Right. That it wasn't just that he brought it and showed it. It actually brought it and stayed there for a while.
It did.
Right.
He let us bang on it all year.
What kind of stuff did you do on it?
I did programming. We didn't have any prepackaged games, but we wrote some of our own games. We wrote a low-res Apple II game that we called Target, that you had two people with paddles, and you had to work together. One had the horizontal, one had the vertical, and you were trying to blow up these little pixels
that were
on the screen. Yeah, it was fun. It was fun until the cassette drive ate it, and that's when I learned about backups.
An early but important lesson.
Indeed.
Nice. Yeah, for me on the PET, it was the case that eventually me and a couple of people, particularly Samir, were playing games on it, like Space Invaders and stuff, were versions of that. That actually wasn't until a few years afterwards. Like, it must have been the first, at least one, maybe 2 years that the, like, so for grades, I don't know, 3, 4, and 5, 4, 5, 6, or whatever the heck it was, that computer, the PET, was there down the hallway, and I got to go down and play with it and just, you know, learn BASIC and do little things in BASIC, and I compare them against what I was doing at home eventually once I had a computer with a keyboard at home. So it was actually that same computer was my only school computer for quite some time, and really until I left that school. I finally went off to what we call junior high up here, middle school, I think, in other locations, and I left behind the PET, and I went to a different school. But for the first few years, it was just that one micro. It was the computer, and it was down the hall, and almost nobody wanted anything to do with it. It was weird. I was all over it. It was like the most exciting thing ever. Way more exciting than like girls. And it explained so much about my past. And so yes, for the longest time for me, it was like little bits of basic programming and you know, I'd read something somewhere or I'd, you know, type away on that keyboard that at the time I loved because it was a keyboard. It was like, oh my goodness, this has a keyboard. That's exciting. But now I look back and go, oh my goodness, that's the worst keyboard ever.
Oh, it is. But that was a blessing, like I've shared before, because everybody wanted on the TRS-80 Model 1 and everybody wanted on the ASR-33 terminal that we had. Nobody wanted on the PET because of that crazy keyboard.
Right.
And so that's how I got all the computer time on the PET. I was just like, I want this, and I don't care if I have to type on it, you know, making my fingers all tight and squishy.
Right.
Like that. It doesn't matter to me. And I, on a side note, I'm in awe of Paul's primary school experience. That sounds like such a progressive setup that they had.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it was kind of like specially selected. You know, I'm not sure that I had to apply to get in there, but you had to choose
to go.
Oh, it
was a special school?
Was it? It was exactly.
I see, Paul. I see. That's why you didn't have to go to real classes.
Right.
You were special. Let's talk about programming classes. Like, eventually, but what for me, it wasn't really until high school that I could take a computers class. And in that, they basically were teaching programming. It wasn't you're taking computers and learning Microsoft Word. The idea was computers were things that you coded on. And I actually got to take a couple of classes that were programming classes by the time I was in high school. So what about you guys? Pre-university, did you also get that sort of experience? Did you get to take a computer class of any sort? Paul, what about you?
I did not. Apart from those sort of informal things, you know, like sort of small projects, there really wasn't much. I sort of feel like the computers were only just, I don't know. It's interesting because the middle school, you know, junior high, school was sort of much more progressive about this. When I got to high school, computers were not really being used for much. You know, some people had them at home. I think there was like a typing room or something where, you know, like essentially you would go to learn to touch type, but that was what the computers were for.
I did that as well. I learned on a typewriter. I took a keyboarding class and it was all electronic or electric typewriters. And we learned to type, which honestly, and I've said this later on, one of the best, most important classes I ever took was that because holy cow, being a fast touch typist has paid off significant dividends through my life.
Yeah, definitely. Although I used to be really good before of having learned touch typing at just sort of, you know, typing catalog very fast and things like this, but you know, and so there is a sort of a dance that your fingers get used to doing, but it's nowhere. I also think that was a very valuable thing to have done, although I didn't wind up doing that until actually quite a bit later.
Yeah, but I remember being in a class with a really tall teacher with a big, big permed hair. So she's kind of like a tree, like a tall trunk, and then a big bloom at the top, whatever her name was. And she'd be walking up and down the aisles and all of the keyboard, and she'd be like, F, 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 space, J, 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 space. Like, that's how we began, typing out in unison, like a little area. It was terrible. It was weird, weird memory. But eventually, we're fast, you know, you became a quick touch typist, and it was paid off, like I say, a lot of dividends. So what about you, Earl? Did you ever take, like, a programming or a computer class pre-university?
It was all programming, actually. The thing starting in the ninth grade that I talked about in the middle school was programming in Fortran, and then all the way through high school. We didn't really do much with the computers other than programming courses.
Right.
And it got so crazy, my friend Arthur and I wanted to take so many computer courses that the school actually had to add computer courses for us because we basically timed out.
That's not a thing anymore. As far as I know, I've got a nephew who's now just gone into grade 11. And as far as I can tell, it's never been offered to him to have a software development course at that age. And I don't know if it's that programming is supposed to be more complicated or.
No, at my daughter's high school, they're offering it.
Maybe they just don't offer it to him.
Which I think is good. And also, you've, I'm sure, noticed all of the rabble-rousing going on these days about teaching kids how to code. Mm-hmm. There are multiple initiatives, some of them gaining a lot of momentum, saying, hey, oh yeah, it actually is good to have people who know how to program computers.
Now, as far as I knew, I thought in America you guys just gave up on education. You actually still have classes and things down there? That's cool. It's good to hear. Because the rumor in the rest of the world is you guys have just said, we're not really interested in it anymore.
Education.
Cool.
Yeah, I'd make something that rhymes, but I'm not educated.
Good to know.
Some people have a way with words and others don't.
Because it's weird, because for me, these are the things that had the most resonance. I was always a good student. I always did well in school. I've got a bunch of degrees. So I went, the distance and beyond when it came to formal education. But in my earliest days, the things that I found most interesting, I was immediately drawn to computers, getting access to an early computer, getting, typing lessons, and then a programming class. I think we just did BASIC and then a little bit of Fortran and a little bit of Pascal is how I remember it. But that, affected me. Like it became the thing I made money in, the thing that I have loved forever. Like it was just a major, major influence on young Edmonton.
Yeah.
So it's like I can't express enough like what a big deal that was. I also don't think it is the case that everybody can or should be a computer programmer. I do think it takes a certain sort of mentality. I don't think you can force people into it. You can be a very good driver without being a mechanic. You can be a very good computer user without necessarily being a programmer. But I do think those who like it should get access to it because as a society, we do kind of need it.
we do. And I'll plus one also on how useful typing has been.
Can you use that as a verb? But okay.
And you guys make me feel old because we learn typing on manual.
It's not us that make you feel old. It's the earth spinning around.
It's just time.
Hundreds of times.
I'm aging 5 years per year these days. But so manual typewriters is what we learned on. And there are some advantages, I think, learning on that kind of an environment.
Well, I learned on a movable type machine. I'll show you when I was a kid.
Carrington, Gutenberg, Vanston.
Exactly. We're pulling the lever one page at a time. luxury. You had typewriters.
Up to half word per minute.
Ours were definitely electric, though, because I remember everyone would turn them on and the whole room would like hum. Because there's like these, the big electric machines. There was 20 of them in a type in class or something. Something like that. Or they were probably big, like those IBM ones or something like that. Like, so big, big metal devices. I love big metal devices.
So one thing that I thought it might be interesting to sort of inject in here is the
inject away.
And yes, is the fact, at least it seems to me, kind of looking back, that kids and sort of like schools were really the kind of like the target, intentional target market for a lot of these things. I mean, I noticed that particularly with Apple, but also with TI to a certain extent. I mean, it was all about. Yeah, all the ads had pictures of kids, enjoying something on the computer or learning something.
Think about this. We're coming out of the 60s, the space race. Technology kits are all the rage. I mean, computers were the buzzword, I think.
But so much of it, I think, was targeted
society.
At the parents to buy the thing for your kid. This will educate them. They'll do their homework. They'll learn all these things. You won't, but buy it for your child, and your child will be a whiz kid.
Think of the commercials that were like that.
Won't you think of the children and buy them a computer with a proper keyboard?
But yeah, so it does. I found it sort of striking that it wasn't, that so much of the advertising seems not to be toward the adults, but toward things that, educational things that you can use with it, and to sort of insert also this. Maybe it was about. Doesn't really matter. Sometime in the not so distant past, I got a hold of a curriculum materials kit from sort of, I think it's the middle of 1979 that Apple sent out to like a set of schools.
Have you scanned it? That's something that should be preserved and made available. Yeah, that's awesome.
Not only that, but the link is in the show notes.
Look at those.
You are the man.
But it is kind of interesting. It's apparently the school would request information packet, and this came with. It came with a little, cover letter, and then talked about why you would want to use a microcomputer versus time sharing, and why an Apple II versus other computers, because this was of course from Apple. And it's interesting to see the actual marketing, particularly back when this is at a point when people hadn't, the push for the Apple II was because it wasn't all that well known. It was new.
Okay, so, this kit is fantastic. Listeners should go to the show notes, and I'm looking at it now over on the YesterBits. This is really cool.
Yeah, I sort of got it by luck too. It wasn't exactly clear what it was, but I sort of guessed, and and eBay rewarded me.
What's funny is the so much of the material seems to have been produced on a typewriter. Rather than a printer. Imagine all these things you can use a computer. Not make this kit, but other things you would be able to do on a computer. So it's awesome. This is really, really cool. Like this whole curriculum stuff. Like this is neat. This is neat.
Yep. Anyway, that was it. That was all I wanted to add to this.
Nice. Yeah, just reading about this whole using a microcomputer in the classroom. And yeah, nice. Good share. I like it. Very cool. So anyway, I figured it was something that probably we had shared and that our listeners have probably shared, like the idea that they were introduced to computers when they were a kid, and it was probably something a lot of people would have first seen in a classroom, or at least first got hands-on in a classroom. So I'd love to hear our listeners' experience in this. So if you've got an experience like this you want to share, you can hit us up on Twitter, where we are at RCR Podcast, or send us email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, because I'm sure the three of us and our missing host today would love to hear your experiences. So I'd love to hear from our listeners on this one. So let's dive into the news, the items of interest, as we put in our show notes, because they are interesting things. And Paul, we're going to kick it off to you first. Make a mess of the items of news. Ha ha, mess. See, I made a joke there. It's about mess. So what have you got?
Well, so quite recently, I think this is all actually since the last time the show was recorded, there's been a major leap forward in the MES emulator. So it's a multi emulator super system or something like this.
Right.
Which is basically the computer counterpart to MAME. Exactly. So this will allow you to run old computer emulate a huge number of old computers, but so in the last week or so, the Apple III emulation has shot forward. It was basically not doing anything before, and it now seems to be working almost perfectly. This is kind of a big deal, I think, because there really had been, up to this point, no good emulation option for the Apple III. So,
and that's what I've always heard from Apple III fans. My co-host on another podcast, Mike McGinnis, has said that to me before, that there never really was great Apple III emulation. There just simply wasn't an option.
Yeah, and there was a project, it's several years old, 5, 10, something like this, called Sara OS. OSX, which is the it's another emulator, but it was unable to work. It broke down somehow running the BASIC. So there's a special flavor of BASIC for the Apple III, the Business BASIC, and it was not clear why, but it just couldn't run Business BASIC stuff. It would just crash, and that's a huge problem, because it's not as bad as it would be on other computers not being able to run BASIC, but it's almost as bad.
Right.
So like most things won't work. Many things did, but most things wouldn't. And so the big leap forward in the MES Apple III emulation was just that it now, the problem had to do with sort of how it handled memory and how, because the Apple III can have quite a bit of memory. I think 256 is the largest Apple provided, and 512 is as large as it can actually get, K, that is. But it's a 6502, and it has a fairly small addressable space. So it had to do a bunch of page swapping, page swapping, flipping, whatever, bank changing. And it
I like
did
swipping.
It in a fairly complex.
I like swipping too from now on.
Too.
It's
yes,
swipping.
Right. Oh, man. anyway, yeah, there was something that was funny about the zero page. It was figured out. And all of a sudden, the MES emulator could do it. And actually, that's one nice thing about having it be embedded in MES, because the point of the thing is that it basically has a lot of shared components to handle all the tasks that are common to emulators. So when you're working on one particular machine, there's already out there sort of disk reading routines and screen printing, routines and things. So it's relatively low barrier. But so the person who's been working on this, I don't know who it is. I'm not sure that this person is known. He is known as R. Belmont.
I'm going to take credit.
Okay.
It's clearly me. Until somebody else steps forward, I would like you all to, thank me.
That's okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But yeah, so he's been working on this recently and has been posting screenshots. Well, he has a blog where he's been talking about this. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Now, the trick about this is it's all in the development branch, so you have to be pretty fancy to get access to it. You have to be able to compile it yourself and run it. And fairly recently, Egan Ford has made a Apple III ready to run bundle for this, so that until it reaches the sort of release state, you can download that and run the emulator. He's preloaded a bunch of stuff on a virtual hard drive, so pretty much right now, you can download it and just be up and running. So I'll also put a link in there for that. It's sort of everything is evolving such that probably by the time this gets heard, it will have evolved a step further. But it is really it's quite exciting and suddenly opens up the Apple III to a whole lot of people who don't actually have the machine.
Really nice. So, really very 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 cool. And probably is the first step towards this. I mean, with all the things they're doing over at archive.org with JS Mess, which bundles in, like right now the focus on other machines, there's no reason why this can't be a step towards eventually being the engine in that for Apple III stuff. So if you're interested in Apple III, you just go to a website and here it is. It's running. Do what you want. So this is exciting.
I think that is pretty much that's nearly guaranteed actually to happen. Yeah. I think they have there's kind of like an automated, mostly automated migration path from
that seems
Mess
to
JS
how it works. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that's exciting. So yeah. As much as maybe right now people might think, do I have to compile? Do I have to do something? Probably this is going to get very quickly opened up to the general public to be very easily accessible. So I love it. Not that the Apple III ever really thrilled me, to be honest. But
well, see, that's the thing. I think this is going to help, though. I think once people who know it love it.
Is there a button to make the screen shake as if I just dropped the machine from a few inches
right,
off the?
Exactly.
Because that should fix it. Because that would be pretty cool. I would use that emulator.
I was thinking that it should be there should be some sort of like random chance at any point that the power supply will fail.
Totally, that's a true emulator. I want emulation at that level.
Just to emulate the terror aspect as well.
Exactly. Well, fantastic. Nice first choice, Earl. I don't know how you can possibly compete with that mess that Paul has left. the puns.
Use a pen, go to jail.
So, what have you got to introduce us to?
Well, people were jumping off bridges. I mean, there were, mass protests. And once again, Commodore saves the day.
Is that how we're going with this? Okay.
So it's true that you can't play Flappy Bird on your iPhone anymore unless you already owned it.
Right.
But now you can have it for your Commodore 64. And we'll have a link in the show notes to the game on the Commodore 64. There's a little video that will show you how exciting, riveting even, that it is to play this on the Commodore 64. And I know that you're all on the edge of your seat. In fact, people are probably pausing the podcast right now to run over and play this. And yeah, it has quelled, all of the civic unrest and... the price of Commodore 64s has gone through the roof.
No doubt, just so you can play Flappy Bird.
Exactly.
On the C64.
So there you go. That's all I've got to say about that.
Well, I'm really not surprised that it got ported, and I think there's also a version for the Atari 2600 now, because it's the kind of game that should be able to run quite well on vintage systems. So, but still, it's kind of neat, and I like it when something that is a big current news story then gets reflected back into the computers we love. And by we love, I mean just Earl loves, whatever. I just have try to be inclusive here. So that's pretty cool. So I'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes. I am going to wrestle this and bring it back to the world of Apple, because that's what I like to do. And the next bit of news...
Of course you are.
Will be the Unitron Mac 512. Now, this is something I never heard of, and it's being billed as what was, back in the day, back in 1985, the world's first Macintosh clone. And it was in Brazil. It seems to have caused quite the kerfuffle, because it basically looks exactly like a Mac. Like, they knocked off the molds, they knocked everything. Like, here it is, there's your Mac 512, and here's the Brazilian version. It just comes with two floppy disks. But otherwise... from a distance, it'd be hard to tell it wasn't the Mac. And the big issue, it seems, that people sort of argue about how much of this is true and how much of this is just the story that developed. that Apple got their hands on one of these. And it was one of the developer versions, but it's one of the ones that didn't have the reverse engineered ROMs. Now, supposedly the engineers in Brazil used the Apple documentation, because there was great documentation for programming the original Macs. So they used that to basically reverse engineer the APIs that were needed, reverse engineer the ROM.
They did clean room like Compaq did.
Supposedly. Yeah, that's what they're saying, that they had that.
Okay.
But then Apple got, before the, just as this got announced, and it got released in a weird way, that it was unveiled to the press with the, you couldn't get near the computers. It was unveiled and they were like hovering over a lake or something. Supposedly, it's kind of weird. Here it is, but you can't touch it. Apple then got a copy of them, and it had actual just Macintosh ROMs in it. They weren't reverse engineered, the actual Mac ROMs. Just, but then the Brazil people were saying, but that's because that was our test unit you snagged. We have the ones here with reverse engine ROMs, but we had to also make sure it was working, so we put your ROMs into this just to test it. And Apple said, oh, sure you did. Went to the State Department in America, who then told Brazil, we will put new tariffs on shoes and oranges if you release this, because it's industrial espionage. Then, so the Brazilian government came down hard on this company and said, you can't do it. We're going to get ourselves sued. Oranges are more important than computers. And then this thing basically didn't get to get released, but was supposedly. Anyway, there's this whole story about it. I didn't know any of this stuff. I found it very, very interesting. And so we'll have a link in the show notes. Now, did either of you guys know anything about this Unitron and the whole story behind it before? Like, Paul, had you heard of this before?
No. Yeah. And it really does just look like a Mac with a couple of PC drives in it.
Totally. and just different languages all over. But it really just, you look at even the inside, it's like, well, this is a Mac. So what about you Earl? The people over in the awful world of Commodore, had they heard about this before?
Have never.
Speak for your people.
Have never heard of this machine. And I think this whole thing is fascinating.
Yeah. I love the whole idea that, like, in this, it talks about how they're being released in, out over a lake, so you couldn't get a hands on. I'm like, they did what? Like, so anyway, the whole thing
that's an air gap.
It's neat to see the pictures of it. It's neat to hear the story, and there's sort of different people saying different versions of the story. I found the whole thing fascinating. It's cool. It's a cool, cool story. And it's funny because I guess the same company that was making this back in the day was also making Apple II clones, and Apple was really turning much more of a blind eye with the Apple II clones. But I guess when this Macintosh came out, they said, no, we're not having it anymore. So they were coming down hard on the idea of knocking them off.
Well, I mean, you can't just copy somebody's ROM.
Right. But that's why they were saying, well, we didn't. We've got these clean room versions, but they didn't seem to actually produce those. But the State Department came down pretty fast on them. Anyway, the whole thing is very interesting, and I think it would make it for a fun, full novel. But I had never heard of this before. I figured it was probably new to a bunch of our listeners as well. So if you're interested in read the story about the Unitron Mac 512 suspended over an artificial lake and the trouble you get in with Tropicana oranges because of it, then we'll have a link over to Cult of Mac and you can read the whole story because it's quite interesting.
Very nice.
Okay, so next up, Paul, we're going to throw it back to you and something about the history of WordPerfect.
We got a suggestion from Mike Whalen let me sort of maybe back up to the beginning of that. The archive.org has been recently putting together a project on business software for the sort of early microcomputers. So it's an area where there hasn't actually been all that much attention paid. You know, everybody remembers the games and all that stuff, but they don't necessarily remember the alternative word processors and, you know, the various kinds of spreadsheets and so forth. And so one of the things they're trying to do is document this whole area. And it's also another way to use the JSMS system. So there's been a push on that, and Mike Whalen, one of the listeners to the podcast, has been helping them put together the descriptions of the different programs. And he came across a pretty interesting document on essentially the history of WordPerfect. I don't think it's published, but it is essentially a book called Almost Perfect by Pete Peterson, or W.E. Pete Peterson. It was written, apparently, it looks like in 1993 or 1998, but it's basically about the founding of WordPerfect Corporation, how it came to be, and sort of a lot. It's actually quite a lot of details about sort of how the company grew and all the sort of individual issues that happened with the different releases and, you know, tensions that occurred within the company. And it's very, very detailed. I mean, like, if you didn't already have an interest in WordPerfect, it's probably got a little more detail than you need, but it is really interesting because this is probably the you know, there probably isn't a recording anywhere but here of a lot of this stuff, certainly not all in one place. So it's interesting. The author was one of the original founders of the company, and wound up more or less being kicked out near the end. Huh. And so there's a flavor that it has, and there is probably worth considering the source when you read all of it, just because not everything was on good terms at the end of it. I think he seems to have written it in a pretty fair way, but I also can't point to a whole lot of places in there where he points out places he made mistakes. So,
right.
But it is interesting. It's interesting to see. It's interesting to know that it's there. It's worth at least a skim.
Very cool. Very cool.
I always love these business retrospectives, like, you know, behind the music kind of things, because there's so much insight there, not just about the things that we remember from vintage computing, but people are people. And it's interesting to try to learn from and not make the same mistakes in modern day business experiences. Like, if you read Fire in the Valley, you find out all the internal conflict and mistakes and, you know, various Emperor's New Clothes sort of things that a lot of the early companies did, like Altair and IMSAI and that kind of thing. And I always love reading this stuff. So thanks a lot. Now you've probably, you know, blown another hour or two of my life. And I'm also glad that archive.org is doing some focusing on the business software, because you're right, it's not as fun as Flight Simulator or that kind of thing, but it was a huge part, particularly of the PC experience. So the IBM PC experience, I mean.
It's very cool. I remember back when I was doing 1 MHz, so reviewing games, and I decided I wanted to review something different. So I decided I would do a shootout of word processors. So I went and collected a bunch of word processors for the Apple IIe. And so I had the ones that I used back in the day. I had ones I had never used before, and I've still got them on a shelf. So I've got 4 or 5, oh gosh, even more than that. Maybe call it 7 to 8 word processor full packages in their boxes. Loaded them up, played with them all, took a bunch of notes. They didn't do the review because essentially I decided these all are unusable. And so because I wanted to review it from the point of view of, like, could you write something modern on them? Compare those to the modern word processors. And honestly, there just is no comparison. Well, like, I found the old games are eminently playable and enjoyable. Old word processors are just beating your head against the wall. It's like, oh gosh, I just couldn't go back. So I didn't end up reviewing them because it would have been all just like, this is terrible, this is terrible. This one, it's also terrible. I hated this one.
So, like, this one was just slightly less terrible.
Yeah. Now, maybe I was just super jaded and I had to, like, get a little more removed and take. So I kept them all because I figured one day I might take another fresh start at it. But honestly, yeah, we're perfect. All of them, can't use them at all.
Even Apple
ones,
works?
Because all of them.
I'd heard that was actually pretty good.
Nope. All of them hated everything. I'm sure I'll get people writing in saying, and the thing is, I never used AppleWorks back in the day, so maybe it was I wasn't familiar enough with it, but I used it to try it for this review. I used WordPerfect, I used AppleWriter, I used, like, all these things, and all of them were completely unusable. You're looking for keyboard commands, you can't see what it's going to look like, trying to get it to work with the printer, and you got to, oh no, memorize this, you know, put your fingers into this position and bang on the keyboard, that will save things. Like, what? Really? Like, we don't get lowercase characters, and you have to see on the screen all the muddled things and imagine what it looked like when it print. Like, all these things that we take for granted now, that you look at the page, and the whole WYSIWYG thing was just sort of in the future compared to the ones I was looking at, and I can't go back. I just can't go back.
So at Epson, with our QX10, there were custom keys on the keyboard for things like italic and bold, and that is very user-friendly. And I was talking to some of my Epson cohorts one day about that, and they said, well, I mean, come on. What's the matter with Shift Control Alternate F7? Yep, it's nice to have the commands on the keyboard.
And the thing is, I used them back in the day, like all through high school and stuff. Like I was using these word processors.
WordStar? Did you use WordStar? I loved WordStar.
Maybe I definitely used Word.
I always just like WordPerfect. I don't know why. It just the. I could never get into that word processor. And man, they were the 500-pound gorilla.
Yeah, I liked it on the Mac for a while. I switched over to Nisus, and I tried. I've used every word processor everywhere, and I've never really been happy with any of them, to be honest. What I need is a minion who just takes down what I say, and that's anything less than that is just going to disappoint me. So anyway, that was my experience with old word processors. So I thought I'd throw that out there that I'm the 500-pound curmudgeon in the room. Okay, so we got two other little points to bring in. The first is tiny little thing about the invention of the operating system. Yeah, whatever. So, Gary Kildall, which sounds like a really like a name you'd use in a first-person shooter. but this opens great phrase at the beginning of this. It says, late one afternoon in the fall of 1974, in the sleepy California seaside town of Pacific Grove, programmer Gary Kildall and electronic engineer John Turod retired for the evening to take on the simpler task of emptying a jug of not-so-good red wine and speculating on the future of our new software tool. And that new software tool essentially was CPM. So this is about the birth of the PC operating system. It's 40 years since this, so it's 40 years of OSs as we think of them, because really this is the sort of the grandbaby of them all.
Yep.
Never really had much effect on the real world, to be honest.
Operating systems, yeah.
Operating systems. I mean, I really am surprised they took off.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of you're going to put in a computer and it's going to boot from a floppy, like it's hard to remember that that was a thing that didn't at one point exist. Right? Some things are so fundamental to the computer experience. It's hard to sometimes remember that they are themselves an invention. So there's a great article over on computerhistory.org about this, about the 40th anniversary of the birth of the PC operating system. Now, have you guys had a chance to read through this very, very long and detailed article?
I have not.
Give it now, we'll wait.
I did get a chance to read most of it, and there was some new information in there as well as some of the stuff that I was already familiar with.
Ooh,
and
you learned stuff?
Yeah, I love learning stuff. Learning stuff is, you know, I'm all about that, man.
I have to purge some things, so I'm at maximum. So
yeah, when you run out of room.
Read this, I'm going to choose to forget about the Cardassians. I'm just going to flush them.
Then you're going to be really confused when you're watching Deep Space Nine. You're going to be like, who?
The Cardassians. Yes, I would get those two confused. Anyway, the vacuous ones, not the scary ones. I guess they're both the scary ones. Maybe that didn't narrow it down. Well, whatever.
I think you can use something like overlays, though, right? And I think that will solve this problem.
Yes, almost certainly it will. So I found this really... I've been reading it, actually.
Compiled, he's interpreted.
I was only exposed to this article at the beginning of our show, so I've actually been reading it during the show. So I said it, and I've only just finished it, and it was actually a really
cheater.
Good read. But I've been multitasking during
this
the show.
This is not an open book test.
Well, too bad. It's a good read. It's well written. I learned stuff too. Anyway, it's really good. So I would recommend our listeners to go off and read it if you're interested in one of the most important things to ever happen ever in computing. If you're interested in that sort of thing, for instance. Now,
and raise a glass to Mr. Kildall. Thank you for his contributions. May he rest in peace. And
raise a glass of cheap red wine.
Yeah, I guess so. That would be appropriate, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Based on the beginning of this.
Now,
and also, go back and listen to the Retrobits interview with Stuart Chaffee, who was his co-host on Computer Chronicles for a long time.
No one listens to Retrobits.
Yeah, well, occasionally they do.
That thing?
And
I did not realize that he was on Computer Chronicles, but you're right.
Yep. He was the co-host with Stuart Chaffee, and actually in our conversation we chat for a while about Gary Kildall. And there is also, if you go to archive.org and do the right combination of search, you can find the tribute episode that Computer Chronicles did for Gary Kildall.
Cool. There's a really good article about him in Bloomberg from quite a few years ago. I just looked it up, called The Man Who Could Have Been Bill Gates.
Yes, and that definitely was one of the, what would you say, the unfortunate bits of baggage that he carried around in his legacy.
Yep.
So.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, if you want something happier, if you want to laugh, ha 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 ha, with a British sense of humor, then I'm going to recommend that you bookmark and get yourself braced for a new version of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure game from back in the day. One of my all-time favorite Infocom games. Came out in 1984, I think, and is famously difficult, famously insanely difficult, and very funny, just like the book and the record and the radio program and the towel and all the various other versions of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, the BBC Radio 4 Extra, to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, is going to be releasing online a new version of it that has in some way been updated. Very few details, so nobody really knows what does updated mean. Will it be new text, new graphics, sound, just the same thing on a website? Who knows? But it's coming out on March 8th. I'm really excited about it, so that's next Saturday. Do not call me next Saturday, because I will be home playing this game. I will not answer your calls. Now, have either of you guys played this game before? Paul, were you a text adventure fan? Have you played the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game?
I definitely have. I don't actually know if I made it to the end without... No, I'm sure I got
you cheated.
Hints.
You cheated.
But I think I did make it to the end. And it was... With this particular one, it does help to be quite familiar with the story ahead of time.
I think you almost have to be, and I'm a massive, massive long-time fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, introduced through the radio programs. I can tell you all the difference between the radio version and the book version and the American TV version the American movie version versus the British television versions. All of that. I'm an obsessive fan of all things Douglas Adams. And so I'm very, very excited about this. I, though, even with how much I knew it, had to resort to hints to try to get through the game because the game's insane. Just absolutely, just like impossibly insane. Like, come on. What about you, Earl? Have you ever played it?
I have never played this one.
Your life is empty.
I know. And I've never read the four books of the trilogy?
So you never read it was the increasingly inaccurately named trilogy, yes, as more and more books came out. So you never read any of them? First three, frankly, are the best ones, everyone would say.
I have not. So I might have to turn in my geek card at this point.
I recommend, my favorite version is the original radio version, so that's the thing to listen to, I would think. 12 nice. Episodes of glorious, wonderful comedy.
Was there mention if they're going to give this away or sell it? Or
I think it's just going to be online. It's a BBC thing. I think it'll simply be online. My concern is it will be something limited to people who have paid a license fee, and us out here in the colonies won't get access. So that's my fear. Nobody said anything. Because it could be that we don't get to play this game. I'll be very disappointed.
Interesting.
So I'll be booking a flight. So we will see. But yes, I would recommend, for those who haven't seen the glory of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, listen to the 12-part radio series. What's particularly fun about it, it was one series of six shows that they thought there's no chance whatsoever could possibly be renewed. So the end of the sixth episode literally kills every major character. They're all died. They all die on mic by being eaten alive. There's no way to get out of it. And then the show gets renewed. So it's like, okay, let's bring them all. And it wasn't a subtle thing. We got to bring them back for episode 7. And then, of course, it's going to get renewed again. So unfortunately, they thought, well, let's not do that again. So it's completely open-ended at the end of it. But then that was it. So it's highly disappointing. But that's how these things go sometimes. Still, it's a wonderful way to spend 12 half-an-hour periods. So just wonderful. So anyway, the game's coming out for fans of old Infocom-type games coming out March 8th. And I will be online playing it, I hope. So
very good.
Going to just to add a little bit to this. It looks like there actually was one 10 years ago, a 20th anniversary.
There
of the
was,
game.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, and the thing is, this has been out in a few formats. There's an online version, there's the original version, there's lots of emulator versions. So I'm just excited that they're doing something to celebrate it, and they say it's going to be an updated version. Nobody seems to know how updated that means. So we will see. We will see. So next up, it's time to buy me things. Let's buy things.
Before you do that, you skipped one of my topics. I think you did it on purpose.
Was it a topic about buying me things?
No. Oh. It wasn't.
Oh,
but
I see it.
But we'll get to that.
What topic did we skip?
It's just a quick question. I am inviting people to either tweet or email the feedback at rcrpodcast.com or however you want to tell us. What do you do with vintage computers? So I got an email.
You mean like when you're done with them, or what do you actually do with them?
What do you actually do with them?
Okay.
I got an email from Oscar, and he said, dear gentlemen of the round table, he has a question for the distinguished, you know, keepers of the table. What do you do with your old machines? So you buy them, you maybe fix them up if they need some fixing, and then you play a game or two, and then do they just sit around? What do you actually do in terms of activities? So I posed that on Twitter.
That would have been a very good host topic. Why didn't you take the chair, dude?
Because I want, well, I, you know, at some point, maybe 2 weeks, 4 weeks from now, I'll get you guys' input on this, but I want to know what other people do with their vintage computers. Obviously, gaming's a big one.
Right.
Like you mentioned, gaming, the games of ye old still play as good as they did back then. Maybe in some ways they're even more fun. But there's other things to do with vintage computers, programming.
No, not word processing.
Maybe not, but you can do some productivity apps. And also, what about interfacing, hooking up to your other electronic doodads and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So I want people to tell us, what do you do with these things? Do they sit on a shelf and just look pretty, like collecting stamps or coins or paintings or whatever? Or do you actually, are they a part of your day-to-day or week-to-week life? So let us know. And that's all
cool.
I wanted to say.
No, so, that's good. I'll be very interested. I'll tweet out about it as well. So we should actively ask our listeners. But meanwhile, if you've got feedback to that, send it to us. You can either like on Twitter, like I said, at RCR Podcast, or you can send us email, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. I would love to hear what people are doing with their, specifically, like what do you do with your vintage computers? I would love to hear how people use their computers.
Yep, me too.
Cool.
And also,
nice.
I will probably shamelessly steal some of the concepts from my book. So help me out with my book, too, because, I mean, why not give me free information?
Why not? Oh, those
shameless
Commodore
plug.
People. Commodore people.
Some home computers are already obsolescent. Their memory limited. Their performance slow. So now a team of software engineers have designed the Enterprise. Unlike its predecessors, the Enterprise's memory can expand and expand to a massive 3,900K. And being the younger generation, it even offers stereo sound. The Enterprise 128. It could be obsolescence built out.
So now can we talk about buying me things?
Fine.
Woohoo! My favorite part, buy me things. So as the host, I'm going to be picking the host's retro computing gift idea that will go in our gift guide over at rcrpodcast.com. And I have decided that what you should buy me, and this one's a nice one, it costs you nothing, so you can simply give it to me. It is a new book called It's Behind You, The Making of a Computer Game. It's written by a fellow named Bob Pape, and it's specifically about a game for the ZX Spectrum. And it's a game called R-Type that he created for the ZX Spectrum, and it's a whole book about the creation of that game. So it's a very detailed look from soup to nuts of the creation of an actual published vintage computer game from back in the day. So I was very excited to hear about this. And rather than publishing it as a traditional book, it's actually just downloadable in lots of formats. You can just for free download it as a PDF file, as a zip file with different format. It's in it like EPUB, etc. There's a Kindle version. So however you get your digital things, you can simply snag yourself a copy and add it to your device. He even has printing tips because originally the plan was to print this through some sort of print-on-demand service, and he decided not to go that way. But because of that, the PDF version is formatted for printing. So he says, well, here's your size and knock it out. Let's just load up a bunch of paper and you can print your own version. It is designed and formatted to actually have a hard copy printed. You can just do it yourself if you want off your printer.
Cool.
So it is by Bob Pape called It's Behind You, The Making of a Computer Game. Price is free. Can't beat that. And we will have a link in the show notes. It's over at bizzly.com, bizzley.com.
Keratin, I think you finally found the one gift that I would consider buying you.
I've changed my mind. It's no longer free. I thought it sounded really interesting. So I haven't read it yet, but the excerpts look really cool. I'm interested in reading stuff about the ZX Spectrum. Free book. Can't beat that. So that's my choice. So now let's talk about other things that can be purchased. We can head over and look at some auction items for the retro computing fans. So who wants to go first? How about you, Paul? What have you selected for our eager listeners to perhaps bid on?
Well, I have selected the something that might actually be familiar to people who have been listening up to now. But
may have recently heard a commercial.
Right. The Enterprise 128 computer, which I had never heard of before. Apparently it is, I guess it must be European. It says on the box here that it was, somewhere made in the United Kingdom. So it's, I don't know what to say about it exactly. Very colorful, has a built-in joystick.
It's an interesting and very unique industrial design. Definitely does not look like other computers.
And I think it's a Z80.
I think so too. Yep, I think so. That's exactly. That was the Z80 computer. I know nothing about it. It has some sort of version of BASIC built in that's different than I'm aware of. Got this built-in joystick though. I like this little joystick that's actually built into the computer.
So
cool.
Yeah, no, it looks really interesting. And this the particular the thing is, when I looked on eBay, there were two of these. This one is the better one. It has the box and everything, but they're both they're very expensive. They're collector quality, or I don't know about quality, but they're collector priced. So they're interesting to look at. This one that I picked is in. It's in the UK, but it ships worldwide.
The other one
was in Hungary.
Comes from Hungary, which I guess in reading about this computer, they manufactured like 80,000 units. It was a complete commercial flop, and so the last 20,000 they shipped off to Hungary. And so it seems that it's bigger in Hungary. I had never heard of this thing before, ever. Until today, this was totally a new computer to me. Earl, I think you had mentioned that maybe you had at least heard of it before.
I have heard of it. And I can't remember where, but okay. I've definitely encountered this one before. Never seen one in person, though.
That was news to me. Anyway, I like it. I like a new form factor I've never seen before. I say good choice, Paul.
I should say also maybe just one further thing. The audio to the ad is interesting, but the video is crazy. So if you there'll definitely be a link in the show notes to the video form of the ad for the Enterprise. The
and that ad, as far as I can tell, the audio is being done by Matt Furrer, who was Max Headroom. And while they don't come out and say it, they're clearly doing the Max Headroom sound, the repeated stuff. So they're and which makes sense if it's a UK computer, because that's a UK thing to start off with. And this comes out in 85, so it's going to be right in the Max Headroom time. So it makes sense that they'd want to capitalize on that. But so it's really a computer of its time and an ad of its time. I liked it.
Yeah.
I like it. Okay. Nice choice, I say. So I'm going to go next. Me. What can I buy me? So
what are you going to buy me?
I'm going to buy me, perhaps. And I don't know if I'd buy this one, but I wanted to bring it up. Because I've noticed this happens on eBay, and there's three or four different sellers now doing this. And so one of them currently has this particular adapter online, but the few people seems to out of nowhere have started doing this. The Apple IIc, not the IIc Plus, but the original Apple IIc, which is a computer that the form factor that I love, because it's the quote-unquote portable, use it on a beach kind of computer, supposedly, with your 110 power, and the little adapter. And that's the thing, is unlike the IIc Plus, that has an integrated power supply, you just use a regular plug, this has an external power brick, and the IIc's power brick weighs more than my current MacBook Pro. The 2C power brick is, it's vintage and the look of it goes well with the 2C. But if it comes to real portability, if you're going to take your 2C down to Kansas Fest, the power brick that comes with the 2C is a pain. Weighs a ton. It's huge. The cord gets tangled. I'm not a fan of the 2C's power brick. And so it's really interesting that out of nowhere, it seems, a bunch of people have created new power adapters for the 2C using modern technology. So it's a little tiny wall wart and then just a small plug and it plugs in. And I think that's fantastic. So I'm going to link to one of them in the show notes over on eBay. But it's the kind of thing that if you just search for power adapter for the 2C, you'll see that a few different suppliers have started offering these things. And that also led me to thinking, what if I plug this in and it blows up my computer? Because it isn't original. They're saying it's tested, but what happens if something goes wrong? Well, if something goes wrong, I've got you covered, dear listener, because it turns out that over at iFixit, which is a fantastic site if you ever want to look at walkthroughs of with your modern computer, say upgrading the RAM, putting a new hard drive in, it has these wonderful walkthroughs. Well, there's a bunch of walkthroughs for doing things in the Apple IIc, on iFixit, one of which is replacing the internal little power regulator. So if you plug in this thing and smoke comes out of your computer, something gets destroyed, iFixit has a guide for swapping that part. So my choice is slightly less risky than it might otherwise have been. But that's what I'm selecting. The nice new light portable Kansas Fest friendly power adapters available on the Apple IIc, and I've selected one in particular to link to.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. Actually, yeah. The fact that first of all, it's often the case that 2Cs get stranded from their power supply, so you can get them, but they don't have the power supply. So it's good to have spares, not even just because the originals are heavy.
Yeah. Now, these aren't cheap. The one I'm linking to is $31.47, a very specific price, it seems. But at least it's free international shipping, so it's free to ship to even Canada, so I like that. There's other ones that seem to be available frequently that are slightly less expensive and slightly different designs, but then they charge for shipping. So anyway, this got 27 days left. There's still two available. It's just to buy it now. So $30 gets you a nice, slim, lightweight, tested power adapter for the Apple II. Won't be vintage, but I say shelve the vintage one, and for actual use and portability, snag one of these. So that's my suggestion.
Very good.
What about you? What have you got to follow up what Paul and I have selected?
Well, I'll talk about yours for just a second, because I heard the Antic folks talking about, if I recall correctly, aftermarket power supplies for the Atari stuff too. So it seems like the things that tend to go bad in these computers, you know, the floppy drives get honked up. And that's a technical term, by the way. And the the power supplies also tend to get unhappy. And so,
well, this same seller sells a bunch for Atari, for like this seller I'm linking to basically just sells new power adapters for old computers.
So it's fascinating that we're finding ways to get around the floppy issue with SD card solutions and that kind of thing. Also finding ways to get around the power supply issues.
And some of us, like Earl, just get around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you got to get around to go around, or whatever that saying is.
Sure. But
yeah, it's something like that. So I, you know, we asked the question before, how much stuff do you replace before it's not a vintage computer anymore? But it seems like the power supply, who cares? So it is just good to see these guys coming out with aftermarket stuff. And it's interesting that there's actually a big enough market to make it marketable.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing that I put in here has already been sold.
Did you buy it? Is that why you picked it? Because you bought it?
It must have been a really good choice, because somebody already came along and bought it.
Nice.
It was one of the vintage plotters, and I just love those things.
Oh.
You know, it's just drawing stuff.
Oh, man, I wish I had bought
that. That is beautiful.
Yeah. Look at this
thing. I've never actually seen one, but it really is. First of all, it's super clean.
We all missed out. This is beautiful.
So when I worked for Epson, we had a plotter called the HI-80 that was a little 8.5 by 11 multi-pin kind of plotter thing, and it was just so incredibly cute. It was an amazing little device, and boy, do I wish I would have kept one, because nothing says this retro stuff like a plotter, right? I mean, that's just, I suppose that they may still be used in some giant vellum industrial applications where you're making gigantic plots. I don't know. They probably use some other kind of technology these days.
Very cool. So this is a TRS-81, the FP215.
Yeah.
And it's got that silver plastic, you know, trying to look like metal look that the TRS-80 stuff had at the time. This would have gone perfect with my Coco.
Yeah, it was very nice. But it's sold. So if you want something that isn't sold, I'm going to steal Michael's eBay auction, which was for some beautiful core memory. Apparently it says from the USSR, and it is in really nice shape. It almost looks like embroidery, because you've got the core memory inside this nice wooden, well, I mean, it was the actual structural stuff that they used for it, but it
actually... We talked about that before. Like, this kind of memory is something you could mount on a wall. It looks like art.
It makes... Yeah. It looks like a nice frame, doesn't it? So, yeah. And it looks like it's in... The person says condition perfect, and it really does look like it is. I mean, sometimes these core memories get a little beat up.
But this one is missiles.
Yeah.
So I'm not entirely sure that I... There, actually, I remember seeing a video that was that somewhere, you know, from like the Navy or something like that was explaining how core memory worked. It was really quite good. But
we linked to that in an earlier show. There's an earlier episode where we linked to this video about how core memory works. So if you go trolling through rcrpodcast.com, you should see it. It was a great video. It was the thing that finally explained to me how the heck that stuff works. But I was always confused.
I was trying to remember if it persists, though. I mean, like, if you remove the power, it stays, right? So I think if I were to get something like this, I would want to try to put something interesting in the memory before I put it on.
Oh, I want to see if there's something interesting in it now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Secret rocket base plans.
Nice.
Can you read it off the... Is it physical? Does it have to do with the physical position?
You have to touch it and see what parts shock you. Ooh, yeah. There's one there. Ooh, there's one there. Ooh,
as I recall, there's a magnetizing wire and there's a sense wire, and you need to be able to run some sort of current or something through the sense wire, and you can, using the matrix of it, because you got the horizontal and the vertical wires that are going through the stuff, you kind of multiplex it out, and you can figure out what's on it. Yeah, but I think you'd probably need some specialized circuitry to do it.
Nice.
Yeah, interesting challenge.
Core memory experts, tell us what you think. But there's only 4K on here, so it's not like you're going to be...
Tons.
Yeah.
That's tons of K.
I think I've seen... I feel like I've seen a fair number of these Russian core memory plates go by. So I think if it's not...
It's how they're currently passing messages to spies.
Ah, yes.
They're just selling it on old core memory.
No longer need to hide the message. Just put it in something that no one can read anymore.
Exactly. Nice. Okay, and that pretty much brings us to the end of the normal part of the show. We'll just do our closing discussions now, wrap it up, and get the old theme song playing. So, Paul, why don't we start with you? What have you got to tell us about life in Paul Land or any last bits of news and such?
Well, One last bit of news that I just noticed as we were kind of going through the show is that we didn't mention, but the speaker has been announced for Kansas Fest 2014.
Kansas Fest, never heard of it.
And so it's Margot Comstock. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Yep, which is a great choice.
I think that is that's excellent. She was the co-founder of the magazine Soft Talk, which was a very big deal magazine, and also it was a great magazine.
It was
a great magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best, if not the best. My favorite. Love it, love it. Loved it at the time. Love it now. And I can't wait to hear her talk.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to hear the stories it's a great time for it.
And for people who don't know, in case you don't know who Margot Comstock is, to give you an idea of why you want to go to Kansas Fest and listen to her talk. So she started and was editor for this amazing magazine, which have tons of stories for the many years running it, but founded the magazine because she went on a TV game show and won the money and used that to start up a magazine. Like, that's how interesting this person is. So she was on Password, won a bunch of money. That's why she started a magazine. Like, how cool is that? So I can't wait to hear the story she has to tell. Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Cool.
Anyway, that's my last bit of news.
Nice. For me, I've just got another comment about gaming. Back in the day, early Macintosh stuff, I used to love humongous entertainment games. I wasn't a young kid, and these were aimed squarely at young children, but things like Spy Fox and the No Need to Hide When It's Dark Outside, like these little children's games, particularly the ones with Pajama Sam, Thunder and Lightning, and Not Very Frightening or whatever. Like, there's these little children's point-and-click games that I just found endlessly entertaining as a high school student or something. They have now all become re-released, and they're available on modern, like, point-and-click platforms. You can get them for the iPad, and I think that's a perfect way to play them. So I'm quite excited. I don't care that I'm in my 40s. I look forward to playing Freddy Fish and the Stolen Shell again.
Pajama Sam, right, was actually really fun.
Totally, yes. And the Spy Fox ones, which were kind of slightly more adult-ish, aimed at, like, you know, 8 to 10 year olds. they were fantastic. I love them. I never played the putt-putt stuff because that was a little too young for me. But But the Freddy Fish and Upwards, Pajama Sam and Spy Fox in particular, I recommend them. You can get them from the Apple Store. I'm quite excited to play them. So I just wanted to say that those are out. And if, like me, you played them or want your kids to play them, then they're available now. So hooray for that. And what about you, Earl? Anything last to throw out there and wrap up?
Just
Earl that, Land?
Regrettably, and now there's no need to cancel the entire RCR because of this. I realize, you know, it'll be hard to do without me, but... I won't be able to be on the next show. 2 weeks from today, we will be at the Northwest Classic Karate Tournament.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, very nicely done.
You can tell I'm trained.
Yeah, so we will be, you know, waxing on and waxing off. But, yeah, I'll be there with you in spirit.
Cool. Nice. I say nice. Right. Nice. You'll be there. Nice.
Nice.
Woo-hoo. Best show ever. I think we should all not be and just make Paul do it by himself. Paul. By himself. Hello, this is Paul.
Hi, it's Paul. I'm at the...
And is my microphone working?
I'm at the round table with no dimensions. I'm a single point in space.
Yeah, it's the retro computing
table
point.
Ever. I am DX over DY.
Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of this truly round table. Thank you very much for everyone for listening. That's the most important part. If you want to give us feedback, we love to get feedback. I've mentioned a few times through the show, you can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast.com. I think Earl, for the most part, tweets out at that, and Earl's an interesting guy, so you should follow us. There are forums where you can discuss it. If you head over to our website, rcrpodcast.com, you'll find the show notes and also a link over to the forum. You can send us email directly to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We read everything we get. Occasionally, we even reply. It's pretty cool. We are a member of the Throwback Network, so if you like our kinds of shows, you'll find more of our kinds of stuff over on that network full of goodies over at throwbacknetwork.net. Please review us on iTunes, sir. Please, the sir may have another star. It's because you give us lots of stars. People find us, and that means Earl is happy. And we like a happy Earl. And that's it. So thank you very much for listening. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Thanks for listening. I'll never find my way back to